Windy City. First of all, to see old friends, Rabbi Brand, and I gave shir while you and you were there. Rabbi Brand was my shir. And David Cohen was really one of the pillars of the OU in his days in New York at the OU. And I get to meet people and faces that I haven't seen literally for decades. I met Faye, who was a close friend of my sister. And there's a man, George Newman, who was a very close friend of my father. And get to meet his son here. So, you know, you never know. The Jewish world is such a tiny world. I'm going to speak a little bit about a very important topic, and then I'm just going to say a Dvar Torah, if that's okay, about the Parsha. So, how much time do I have? Okay, so I'll try to be Makatzer and everything. The topic I'm going to be speaking about is Bishul Akum. Maybe I'll get the story about what's the issue of Bishul Akum about coffee. But Bishul Akum is a halacha based on a Mishnah. The Mishnah says in Avodah Zarah that shlokos, things which a goy cooks, if it meets certain criterion, are forbidden. And the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah says there's certain things the Mishnah mentions that are also the enisum isa hanon, and amongst them is pas akum, something that you may be familiar with, the hashlokos. And Rashi says shlokos is called dovashi bishul over kochovim. Rashi in the Mishnah says the reason Chazal forbade Bishul Akum is because of chasnus. It was meant as a bulwark against intermarriage. Now, it's worth pausing at this point to recognize, I'm sure all of you are familiar by now, about the Pew Report with its devastating conclusion that the rate of intermarriage in the United States outside the Orthodox community is something in the range of 70% or above 70%, which is just catastrophic because what also the study shows that the next generation of intermarried, even if with the mother who is Jewish, their children won't view themselves as being Jewish, and of course the continuity will collapse. So the demographic and spiritual challenge for American Jews is something of deep concern. Yeah. Yeah, okay, I'll try to speak louder. and Chazal instituted, knowing this issue, certain bulwarks against intermarriage to sort of limit fraternization or this kind of contact between Jews and non-Jews. And one way is, of course, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. So a lot of it focuses on food. And that was the reason for Bishul Akum. There are certain leniencies as relates to Bishul Akum. And one of them is that, well, it has to meet two criterion. One is that it has to be nechel kamosh, something which is not nechel kamosh shulchai, something that can't be eaten raw, something that has to be cooked. If it can be eaten raw, for example, it's an apple and it's cooked, that's not a problem. Carrots cooked, not a problem, because it's nechel kamosh shulchai. And the other criterion, which is much more vague, is that it has to be ola al shulchan malachim. Ola al shulchan malachim literally means it's something that's served at a king's table, right? So in other words, it has to be something significant. If it's, and for example, the OU's position, not everybody agrees to this, but the OU's position is, for example, potato chips. Potato chips are cooked. It's junk food. So junk food doesn't meet the criterion of Ola Shulchan Malachim. Obviously, what Ola Shulchan Malachim is, I'm going to see if I have some time to talk about what that criterion is, but that's an important criterion. So a rib steak, that's certainly Ola Shulchan Malachim, and that would be forbidden. It doesn't have to be as expensive or fancy as a rib steak to be Asa. But it's a halacha that's important to know, especially nowadays in... For the OU, it's critical to know because we're dealing with factories all around the globe. We have close to 8,000 facilities in 80 countries around the globe. And contrary to what it says in the elders, you know, the elders of Zion, protocols of the elders of Zion, we don't control everything, the Vila. So we have, you know, we have to set up a system to be concerned about the issue of Bishul Akum, and I'll talk to you if I have a moment about some of those things. First of all, I just want to speak about just the lumdus for a moment in terms of the definition of the gzeira they made. Lashi in the Mishnah I just mentioned says that the reason Bishalakim is also because of what? Intimash, chasnus. In the Gemara, when he deals with it, because the Gemara is searching what the reason is, quotes in Asmach, the Gemara says, no, that's not the reason, a pasuk is just Midrabonim. So the Lashi in the Gemara says that the reason is Shema Yachilenu Dovatame. Lest if the guy cooks you, he's going to put in a little chazu at the end. It's something, a non-kosher ingredient. And to be careful, that's why they want to make sure that you're in control of the cooking. And that's why they ask to be shalakim. Tosis already points out that Rashi gives the vision of chasnus in the Mishnah. And here he says, and when it is within the Gemara, he says it's osu mishum shemichalena davatami. There could be actually a difference between these two reasons, and I'll just explain to you for a second why Rashi gives two reasons. Because there's another category which is called pas akum. Pas akum means that bread or bakery goods that were cooked by a goy are called pas akum. As relates to pas akum, there are many leniencies. I'm going to mention two. One leniency is that when you buy it, it's not a personal relationship. It's bought in a commercial bakery, what Chazal call a palter. So that's not, as relates to bread, that's not usur. We assume, however, as relates to other products, bishul, that it is usur. The Moshe Feinstein has a leniency, which he thinks that things that are bought in a, in a factory, and it's something which is uniquely made in a factory, it's not something that you could easily make in your house, those things are not usur because of bishul akum, because they're like a kind of a palta that would be mutter even bishul, even though palta normally wouldn't be, but this is only made for, you know, commercially, so that there's no chashash of chasnus. Generally speaking, most people have not accepted Ramosh's that cooler. But as it relates to pas akum, that one cooler is palta. The other cooler, the other leniency is that even if the Jew didn't actually bake it, but if he participated in the most minuscule fashion, for example, he added heat to it. It was cooking in a stove. Either I lit the fire, I stoked the coals, I threw even a splinter of wood, and then I cooked. That's mut as relates to pas. Whether that's permitted also as relates to bishul is a machloikus between the Mechaber and the Ramah, and is a machloikus who we shine him. Most Chochmei Sfarad, the Ran and the Rosh, who was a transitions figure, and the Rambam from the Stimus Lashon Rambam say that this leniency only relates to pas, not to bishul. The Ramah, however, following the opinion quoted in Tosis and the Mordechai, says that this leniency also applies to what? To bishul. So here we have a very big divide, demographically, because Sfardim follow the opinion of who? Of the Mechaber, of the Shulchan Aruch, Yosef Karo, and they say that this leniency only applies to what? To pas, not to bishul. While Ashkenazim rely on it, and it would mean that if the Jew lit the fire, even though he didn't actually do the cooking, that would be okay. Now this issue became an important issue for us in, this goes back about 25 years or more, when we have to remember at that time about half the population in Israel are Sfardim, Eidot Mizrach, half Ashkenazim. So the chief rabbi of Israel at the time, the Mordechai Eliyahu, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, said the tuna fish that's being imported into Israel, that what we relied on when we cooked the tuna fish is I'm going to tell you we have other leniencies also, which I think would have applied to him as well. But if we light the fire, the Mashgiach goes, he lights the fire, he lights the pilot light of the boiler, and that should be sufficient, and therefore there's not a problem bishul akum. So Mordechai Eliyahu said, that's good for Ashkenazim, but what about for Eidot Mizrach? And so we set up a system. Most of the tuna that was coming in then was coming in from Puerto Rico. We set up a system of having the Mashgiach actually, you know, help put these big wagons filled with tuna cans into the retorts to be cooked to accommodate the Mordechai Eliezer's concern. So, you know, that issue is an important issue. I'm going to see how we deal with it in other times. Rabbi Lam told me once, this was in 1992, there were Svadim who were students in Yeshiva University, and the concern was, how do they eat in the cafeteria? The Mashkiach lights the fire there, but it's not that the cooks themselves, the chefs, weren't Jewish. So for Svadim, how do they eat this? And he said, he sent the Shaila to Rabban Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, you know, how do we handle this? And Rabban says he remembers when he first came to America with his father in 19, whatever it was, in the 1930s, so that this issue came up, and his father had a solution to this. But Rabbi Lam, he wrote so poetically in the Shaila to Rabban, he said, we have to solve this, otherwise we'll have another Gerush Svarad. This was 1990, it was the 500th anniversary of the expulsion from Spain. So they solved that problem. So I'm going to tell you what some of the issues that we deal with. But one of the things is, why did Rashi, Tosis posed this question, why did Rashi mention two reasons for the question of Bishul Akum? Namely, Chasnus and also Bishul. There may be a difference in this respect, I would suggest, between Pas Akum and Bishul Akum. There is a historical machloikus amongst the Rishonim, which has consequences lahalacha, in terms of the history of these two gzeiros when they were made. Was Pas made first and then the Bishul Akum was made? Or they were made simultaneous, or Bishul was made first and then Pas leniencies were introduced, because Pas is a staple of our life, as Rishonim say, Ki lechem yichya ha'adam. So therefore there were certainly certain leniencies, I've mentioned two. But then the leniencies are only as relates to Pas, have no consequence in terms of Bishul. Well, it could be that the question is, what's the nature of the gzeira the Chazal said about Bishul? Did they say that if a goy cooks this, it becomes osa? It becomes like chaza, in quotes, obviously. It becomes a chefze machal sasuris. Oh no, it's a gzeira the Chazal said, because the gava, be careful, because it could lead to intermarriage, to chasnus. Well, there's a very big difference in this question. One of the differences, whether if something's osa mishum bishul akum, will it asu your kalim? Do we say tam ki'ika? If it's only a gzeira, and it's not that the cheftz is also, it doesn't asu the kalim. If it becomes a cheftz machol sasuris, then it would asu the kalim. Well, this issue actually is machloikes between the Rashba and the Rosh, and in Shulchan Aruch there are two dais about this, whether bishul akum, goy cooked, whatever it was, you know, something significant, right? Does that asa the kalim? All the ingredients are kosher, just the guy did the cooking. Does it asa the kalim? 2 days in Shulchan Aruch, we tend to be machmir about that. Not so posher that we're machmir, but since the 2 days, we're machmir about it. So it could revolve around that issue. And in this question, it could be that's what Rashi says. Rashi says, the motivation for Chazal was chasnus, intermarriage, to prevent intermarriage. But in the formulation of the gzeira, chaloisa gzeira, they said that it becomes a cheftz machalos asus. That's why Rashi ends shemichala and dover tamei. And because as an example to this, we always have to distinguish the Rashbon of Avodah Zorah points this out as relates to just a parallel gzeira, which they also made. They said, we know the halach of stam yenam, that if wine was made or even touched by a goy, so it becomes asur, right? The Gemara has two reasons for it. One is mishum b'noseyem, again, as a bulwark against intermarriage, and also because of yayin nesach. So the Rashbon, what do you need both? So the Rashbon says, and the Tosfos B'chanan say, that the reason Chazal did it, the sociological need to make the gzeira was what? Chasnus, which, as I said today, is unfortunately very much breathing on us beyond on our shoulders, and a matter of great concern. But the formulation of the gzeira, we always distinguish between the motivation and the formulation. But the formulation of the gzeira was they used it because called the tikkun rabbanu kein diraisa took. They used the category, the diraisa category of yain nesach, yain which was used as a libation in a adulterous ceremony becomes osur bahano also, and therefore they said that the yain is like midrabanan, like yain nesach, and it's also osu b'hanoah. So the reason might have been chasnus, but the chaloisa gzeira was what? Could be shemichalin davatami davatami. If that's true, then there'll be tamkika maybe. But it could be that by pas, they only, since they're more lenient about pas, they only made a gzeira mishum chasnus, and therefore we have the leniencies. When chasnus doesn't come into play, for example, when it's a commercial, you're buying from what? A bakery. So then it's permitted. We generally, about pas akum, are lenient about it, except during the aseres yemetshuva, where we try to be more machmir in general about our behavior and hoga. Now Tosis says, Tosis quotes in the name of Avram Reb David, and he thinks that the reason is because maybe he'll put some non-kosher ingredient in, and therefore he has a leniency that if it's done, even if the goy is cooking but he's cooking in a Jewish home, you know, as I have somebody who's working for me, non-Jewish, right, an au pair or somebody, and she does the cooking, this Rabbi Avraham Reb David, the Ravid, not the Ravid, the Baal HaSogas, says that it's permitted. We generally don't rely on that by itself, maybe with Tzirif or the Heterim, but not by itself. Rabbi Vadya Yosef, in his Tshuvas, speaks about, he asks, how are Sfardim allowed to eat in hotels in Israel? After all, you know, the chefs aren't Jewish, and they're not, according to the Amor, or according to the Mechaber, what you'd have to do is you'd have to put the kettle on the fire yourself, if you were right, lining the fire previously wouldn't help for the Svardim, right? So Rabbi Vadya has a tshuva, and he says it's a little not lechatchil. He says you're permitted because we're mitzaref many kulos. First of all, you have the Ramah, and then you have, since these are the workers in the are being paid, they're not doing it out of, you know, this is not a romantic experience for them. This is just they're getting a minimum wage, whatever it is. So that the schirim, which is quoted in the Shach and others that we're makil about. And he has several other tshuv, you know, studim lekulos. Who says lechatchila? Of course, better that they should be. You should go to a place where they're actually doing the cooking. The yidden are doing the cooking. But if not, he relies on those tzirufim. Now, I just want to talk for a second about roy lalos al shulchan melachim. What does that very enigmatic phrase mean? Something that could be served at a king's table, that's what's forbidden. But if it's not, then it's permitted. What does roy lalos al shulchan melachim mean? Now that can be interpreted in one of two ways. One way is that it has to be something that's really, you know, something significant or, you know, higher level. So popcorn is not included in that, right? We said junk food is not included in that. Is that what it means? Or does it mean something, that it's not an inferior grade, something that even the king could eat? But, you know, kings don't only eat at state dinners. They have breakfast also. So the question would be, something like sardines. So I'll tell you a story that Rabbi Schwab, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, told me. Rabbi Schwab told me that in about 1948, he went to Israel, right after coming to Medina, and he met with the Chazon Ish, and he asked the Chazon Ish about sardines. Are you allowed to eat sardines? Do we have to worry about the problem, just canned sardines, about Bishal Akum? And so the Chazon Ish said, he thinks it's us, he thinks it's Bishal Akum. So Rabbi Schwab said, but he thought that many of the Gedolim in Europe were makil about it. Amongst them were Reb Chaim Oizer and others. So he said, Zehim Gehaltnis Mutter Gehaltnis Osser. Obviously there's a difference of opinion here. They think it's Mutter, I think it's Osser. So then Rabbi Schwab kept probing, said, but sardines, Ola Shulchan Malachim? Is that what you serve at a state? So he said, the Chazon Ish, as the Kenning from England, the King of England, when he eats breakfast, right? This was King George at the time, right? That when the King of England eats breakfast, he has sardines also. So Rabbi Schwab told him that since he heard him, Mipeh Kotsho of the Chazon Ish, he was always machmir about this. But the issue is, how do you define Olah Shulchan Alachim? Does Olah Shulchan Alachim mean it's not an inferior grade, something that king could eat, right? Or is it something that you serve, you know, Shulah Shlomo B'Shaito? So, and the difference in this definition is huge, because if you take the more restrictive position of the Chazon Ish, there are a lot of things that fall under the category of Bishalakim. If you take the more, the more lenient position, which takes the words more literally, Olah Shulchan Alachim means that which a king would eat, right? Not would eat, but would, you know, you'd serve at that kind of a meal, then the sardines would be mutter. So I spoke to the Rav about it. He thought that the definition of Olah Shulchan Alachim was as the words imply. So, the difference, I thought, may depend on two deis and a toisus. There's another gzeira, which that very same Mishnah there in Avodah Zorah speaks about, and that's sheicha. Sheicha means beer, or some kind of, intoxicating drink, alcoholic drink. So, the Mishnah says that you're not allowed to drink sheicha with goyim in certain circumstances. Most of the people are, depending on the environment, there are other certain criterion. So Tosis asks, why did they have to make a separate gzeira for sheicha? Sheicha should have been also anyhow because of what? Because of bishalakum. And Tosis gives two answers to that. Apparently, the way they made their sheicha, they would ferment some fruits or whatever it is, and cook it. So Tosis has two answers. One teres Tosis says is because sheicha is not olah shulchan alachim. The second teres Tosis says is sheicha you make a shahakol on. So what does that mean? And it could be, though it's not conclusive, I was thinking, it could be that these 2 days, the reason of the 2 terutzim is because they disagree about something. You know, the teres that says, that doesn't answer because it's not all Shulchan Malachim, he thinks that Sheikha is all on Shulchan Malachim. Right? So what's the difference? Because, the first day thinks it's not all Shulchan Malachim, because on Shulchan Malachim you don't serve beer. You know, if it's a, remember Obama had the beer summit?
Yeah.
But at state dinners, you don't serve beer, you serve, fancy wine. So maybe that's what's in dispute in these 2 days in Tosis. What does Tosis mean when he says you make a shahakol? Shahakol? You make a shahakol on a rib steak. So what does Tosis mean because you make a shahakol on it? I think what Tosis meant is this. Sheicha, let's say the way we make beer, right? You put hops in. Why don't you make a mezoinis on beer? Well, the answer is because it's completely incidental. That's just to flavor it. It's basically water. Right, that's why you make a shahakol, right? So he's saying the sheicha also, the whatever it is that they were cooking, fermenting within it, that's incidental. It's meant to flavor the water, right? So that's what he meant, shahakol. Coming to coffee, somebody asked about bishalakim as it relates to coffee. The Gilyam Ashur, Shlomo Eger, Rabbi Kiv Eger's son, quotes this Tosfos, and he says, and he speaks about coffee houses, and he quotes this Tosis to say that's why isn't coffee a problem of Bishalakum? So he quotes this Tosis, that's why it's not a problem, because it's Shahak and others. You don't make a eights on it, even though they're coffee beans. You make a Shahako. All right, I mean, eights wouldn't have been anyhow because it's not Susapri, it's only Seya, but all right. So that's another criterion that we have to know, is it Olah Shulchan Alachim. Another criterion is it Nechel Kamo Shulchai? And then the question is, what does Nechel Kamo Shulchai mean? You know, I told you we had this big issue about the tuna. And actually at the time, I'm saying it's a big issue, at the time it was a huge issue. It was in all the papers, and like there was this is the chief rabbin's demand, and so on. And we worked it out at the time. I just want to tell you an interesting point. At the time, to accommodate Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, he had a Rambam which I did, actually in Hilchos Shamshi, I didn't think was that relevant at all, but anyhow, he thought it was relevant. He was a very extraordinary person in terms of his personality, and he was a very big expert in Taras and Mishpacha and a tremendous lover of Zion. So we accommodated him. But there's really a much easier way, instead of having the Mashgiach put everything in. And this is what Rav Avadya Yosef writes in his tshuvas. And in one of the publications of the OU, the Masorah magazine, we had a tshuva from the next chief rabbi, Rav Bakshi Daron, who also was lenient. And he said like this, and it's so logical. Rav Avadya Yosef quotes the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer, the Sochet Shavah. The Avnei Nezer says like this. He said, true, according to the Mechaber and for Sfadim, it's not enough just to light the fire. You have to actually do the cooking for not to be Bishalakim, right? The Jew has to do the cooking. But he said, let's say in this context of this plant in Puerto Rico, right? Let the workers put in, what does Mashkir have to break his back, which, you know, trying to put all, which is really beyond reality that's in terms of getting done, putting all these wagons with the cans into the retort. Let the factory run with its normal standard. It puts it in, right? Then, when it comes at the end, let the Mashgiach just flick the switch and put on the heat. Because he said that's not just lighting a fire. When you put that on, you're cooking it. He said it doesn't mean that you have to have a fire and you put, like the Sfisas Kerev, you put the Kedeva, the pot on the fire. If the fire is ready in the oven and you turn it on, that's the cooking. It's, you know, the Avnei Nezer offhand is completely right. So that for some reason, Mordechai Eliyahu didn't want to accept that, but it's eminently reasonable, and that's what Rav Avadya Yosef quoting the Avnei Nezer, and as you know, Rav Avadya Yosef in his quoting many many other people was lenient about. There's another heter which I want to mention, which is very, very important in terms of American factories, and that is there's another leniency, which is if it's ma'ushan. Ma'ushan means something that's smoked is not forbidden in terms of bishalakim. So, classically, for example, if you get lox, right, or salmon from Norway, so, you know, we consider lox or salmon to be, even normally fish can only be gotten if you know it's reliable in terms of the source of the fish. That's another example in the Kiveh Dokim. But salmon has its own pink hue, and makes it identifiable as salmon. And therefore, if it's purely smoked, and that's the only thing that they smoke in the smokehouse there, it would be permitted. There's no problem with bishalakum. Now, in America, just you should be aware, a lot of factories that make these kind of lox or smoked things, it's not just being smoked with, you know, like in with a smokehouse burning chips of wood. It's being smoked. It's actually first being cooked, and then the smoke is put in afterwards to give it flavor. But it's not that the smoke is actually curing the product so you can eat it. But let's take classical smoking. That would be permitted, right? Because ma'ushan is a question in Yerushalmi whether ishun is considered cooking or not. And therefore, as it relates to bishul akum, which is only drabonon, in general about bishul akum, we tend to be maker, to be lenient. Now the question is, what if something is cooked with steam? Is that included under Ishun? So that's a machlokes ha-poiskim. Many poiskim think that steam is permitted, and that falls under Ishun. Others think otherwise. So I want to just bring a raya that Ishun means also cooked in steam. And because in Shulchan Aruch it says that Ishun is as relates to, you know, there's a prohibition to cook meat and milk together. Not only aren't you allowed to eat them together, you're not allowed to cook them together, right? Cooking itself is forbidden. So if you cook meat and milk together, what if you cook it together with ishun? So in Shulchan Aruch it says you're not allowed to do that, because again, since ishun, smoking, is a question whether that's called to be considered bishul or not, as relates to cooking meat and milk together, which is the deraisa prohibition, we're stringent. Even though as relates to bishulakim, we're lenient, right? So now the question is, what's the case of ishun? So the Prisha says the case is like this. I have meat in milk, in a pot of milk, and it's being cooked by the ishun on the other side of the pot. So it's clear, the reason he does this is because he's bothered, after all, Tzli is machlokes rishonim, whether that's osam d'oraisa or tigun. So isn't ishun even further away from cooking that we should be lenient about it? So he says, well, this is the case. Well, if that's the case, as the Prisha, you know, pictures it, then there are two things we see. We see that the ishun we're talking about is not just a cold smoke. So offhand, steam would be included. The other thing we see is what? The other thing we see is, which is a shaila, what if I have, for example, this is standard in factories, I have, let's say I have vegetables in a can, there's juice in the can, right? It goes through a retort. A retort is a huge oven, right? And steam is introduced, and then it's cooked in its own juices, right? We know the experience, don't we? Right? So it's cooked in its own juice, what's there? Is that, so some want to be lenient, and they say that's called ishun, and it's mutter. Others, which seems more logical, say, that's not called ishun, that's called cooking. Just, I'm introducing the heat source is the steam, but the form of the cooking is actually in the liquid. It's liquid, it's not steam. But this Prisha would seem to be lenient, because he seems to say that you're cooking the meat in the milk, and the ishun is only the introducing the heat. I once spoke to Rav Yoshev Zichron Levracha about this, and of course he knew the Prisha, and he said he still thought it's one shouldn't be lenient about it. But we generally, at least within the OU system, we rely on those leniencies if something is cooked in steam, live steam, not in a can, that we're lenient. Coming back to our tuna fish story, well, the tuna fish, the way tuna fish is processed is the tuna, the three species of tuna that are kosher and used commercially. Yellowfin, albacore, and... here we go again, age is showing. Governor Perry, where are you to help me out? I'm not running for president. And skipjack, thank you, skipjack. So these, what happens in a plant is those they come in. The tuna is about this size; it's not the size of a whale, and it's skinned by hand. But before they do the skinning, they heat it in live steam, and that way the skin comes off much easier. At that point is when it's really delectable. You know, tuna as it's served at a chasana. It's then butchered and put into cans and reheated at high temperatures, as I spoke to before, in these large ovens. The reason that they're cooking it again is not for the flavor. They're cooking it to kill any potential microbes that are there. So it's for health reasons. So really, it's already nechel, it's already Me'ushan, which is permitted, and so that's another leniency. So I once wrote Avram Shapiro, Zichron Levracha, who was the Ashkenazi chief rabbi. I wrote him a tshuva with, you know, the different reasons why we thought the tuna fish was good, even for, you know, those following the opinion of the Mechaber. So that's an important issue: is ishun permitted even in a factory setting? That's what's really most important. The other question that comes out nowadays is, what about cooking in a microwave? Is that forbidden? Is that bishulakum? Because it's not really, the heat is it's not you cooking it in, well, you all know what a microwave is, right? So is that forbidden or not? So I would have thought, this is what I would have guessed, in terms of cooking in a microwave, there's a big machlokes between Reb Moshe Feinstein and Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Reb Moshe Feinstein was of opinion that cooking in a microwave was considered midiraisa bishul, because he said, even though the Gemara says that cooking in the sun, in the heat of the sun, is not forbidden, because it's and if it's cooked only because something which is derivative of the sun, it's told the schama, it's because Rashi, it's lav derech bishul bekach. That's not the way we cook. So Moshe argues, but a microwave nowadays is the way we cook. So it's derech bishul, and therefore will be osam d'iraisa. But Shlomo Zalman says, no, that when the Gemara says that means cooking in the sun, that's not, in the time of the Torah, when the Torah was given, that wasn't called bishul, and remains, that's not included under the category of bishul. And so, the difference would be, for example, in Israel they have these large, Dud HaShemesh. Would that be osam d'iraisa midirabbanan? That thing which was cooked, the water. So what about cooking in a microwave? So this is what I would have guessed. I would have guessed that according to Reb Moshe Feinstein, it might be Osir, because he thinks that's Bishul Midiraisa. And according to Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I thought he'd consider microwave cooking mutter. I went to speak to Reb Shlomo Zalman about it. To my surprise, he said, no, microwave is on Drabonon, and therefore this is also Midrabonon. But not every, and therefore we accept that as the all-used position, but not all people think that. I know that Rabbi Heinemann is of the opinion that cooking in a microwave is not osol special akum. I think Rabbi Teitz told me he relies on that, and he gives a hashgach and a Dunkin' Donuts, but there are different opinions about that, depending about, first of all, you have to know what you think about the microwave, and then even if you think microwave is cooking midiraisa, maybe, after all, mu'ushan might be midiraisa, but still, we're still makil about it as relates to bishul akum. So those are some of the issues that we deal with. I just want to end with a dvar Torah about the parsha, because it relates to the book that I wrote, and I'll just tell you a little bit about it. I became very close friends with Bill Clinton about 20 years ago, because I once introduced him at an event when he was then Governor Clinton running for president, and I introduced him, and if you recall at the time, Bush, George Bush the first, used to say, people used to complain about the vision thing, as he would call it. And when I introduced Bill Clinton, I said that, vision is an essential ingredient of leadership, and as the scripture tells us, it's a Pasuk in Mishlei, where there is no vision, the people perish. And Clinton liked the line. He said, I like that. I may use it at my acceptance speech at the convention. And indeed, it became sort of this, if you recall, the acceptance speech. It became the central rhetorical theme for part of the speech. He kept coming, but where there is no vision, Bush mocks us by saying, and then he'd come back to, and it sort of became one of the themes of the campaign. And he would invite me often to the White House. We began a correspondence because of it about the Bible. And one of the first pieces that I wrote him was about last week's parsha. So I want to share it with you. In last week's parsha in Vayigash, we see the confrontation between Yosef and Yehuda. And in the Medrash, we see, why are all the other brothers silent at the time? Well, the other brothers are silent because they know this is a confrontation. To whom will leadership ultimately be given? To whom will kingship be given? We know that Yaakov initially intended to give it to whom? To Yosef. But he gives it to Yehuda. And one would have thought that Yehuda, that Yosef was so much more suitable as a candidate. And this is like a red line throughout Tanakh and Medrash, the confrontation between Yehuda and Yosef about Malchus. And even to the end of days, there's Melech, right, Mashiach ben David, but there's Mashiach ben Yosef as well. Because Yosef seems to be so suitable. He was a king. He saved the land from famine. He's a brilliant administrator. He seems perfect in every way. He never gives in to temptation. Why Yehuda? So the answer Rav Soloveitchik quoted, and it's in our new Chumash as well, that was where the OU published. The Rav said, based on a Medrash, and also there's a Tosfos like this, the Rav said, the word Yehuda has a dual semantics. One thing Yehuda means is, as Leah says, I thank God, right? Yehuda, lahodot, means to thank, and it also means to admit. What we look for in a king and a leader is not perfection. What we look for is the ability to admit a mistake. And not to be wedded to a disastrous policy. You look at Lincoln, our greatest president and leader. You know, he was so flexible in his policy. You know, and he was willing to change policy in order to get the result he needed. He knew he had to keep the border states within the Union, or as you would say, everything would be lost. Though he was committed always to, you know, ultimately the extinction, putting slavery, as he said, on the path of ultimate extinction. So that flexibility was what marked Lincoln, not to mention that he was a genius and a man of extraordinary character. So I wrote this to Clinton at the time because people were criticizing him because he was, you know, he changed his mind. And I thought that was a good thing. You know, we don't want to have presidents who are stubborn and never change their mind. But they change based on new evidence or new circumstances. And I cited this when my daughter typed this for me. And she's signing the story Yehuda with Tama and Yehuda. This was a little prescient. This was way before the Lewinsky story. And so she wrote Genesis 28. So Bill Clinton wrote me back a handwritten note. By the way, it's Genesis 38. And then I discovered, you know, as we became good friends, I mean, I could tell you a lot about Bill. I was with him last week. I'm sure this is without dispute. There'll be those who are for opposed him. He's a man just in terms of his intellect. He's stunning, and he's also a very gracious and generous person and a very good friend. And he's very, very committed to Israel. One can agree or disagree with the policy in terms of, you know, the so-called peace process, but in terms of his, you know, his affinity, both his and Hillary's, for Israel, it's quite extraordinary. So I was with him last week, and I gave my son did a report about, but my grandson, Yonatan, did a report about Bill Clinton. And he's in first grade. He spelled almost every word wrong in the report. So I gave it to the president. He's the opposite of Obama. This one, he'd never do this, you know, because he looks like, so he wrote to Yonatan, you know, great report, great job, Bill Clinton, December 3rd, which happens to be Yonatan's birthday. So he was in seventh heaven. But so he's, and his knowledge of the Bible, I just want to end with this, is also, you know, this book testifies to two things about Bill Clinton. First of all, his extraordinary intellectual curiosity, and also his openness. One of the people who wrote in this book was a fellow, Martin Marty, who I got to know through Bill Clinton, who was a professor he's a professor of Christianity, a theologian in Chicago. Some of you in the University of Chicago, I don't know if anybody here heard of him. He's a very prominent theologian. By now he's emeritus, he's an older man. But he told me this story. He said he was at the White House with many leading Christian theologians and leaders of all the different streams, evangelicals, Catholics, different Protestant denominations. And one of them, who's very prominent, whose name I'm not going to mention because Martin Marty asked me not to mention his name, said, "Mr. President, I've been praying for you." So the president asked him, "What have you been praying?" So he said, he quotes a verse from Chronicles 1. Chronicles is Divrei HaYomim. I don't want to have a show of hands how many of us here have ever looked into Divrei HaYomim. But anyhow, so Clinton looks and says, "I believe that's in Chronicles too." So, you know, I've had that experience with him lots of times, his knowledge of the Bible. I don't mean to say that adherence in every respect, but his knowledge is very impressive. And he, in general, you know, we view people always in a certain context. So that's one way to view him. Yeah. I'm sure you want to ask about Bishlaku.
Thanks for your remarks. I just got a question. I don't know if it is time for questions, but I just find it interesting. He's speaking a lot about Bishop Akum and the Gezeiros for intermarriage. As I'm sure you've been asked this question many times, you know, Bill Clinton's daughter intermarried a Jew. Has that affected your relationship with him?
No. It only has affected me in this one respect. I mean, you know, that shows in terms of the... I'll tell you a story. I mean, it's obviously this erosion in the Jewish community in terms of intermarriage is something of... I began my remarks with it. It's something enormously worrisome, and this is a point in fact, you know, to demonstrate it. But I was in an event with Bill Clinton. This goes back about 3 years ago. It was Yitzhak Rabin's 15th Yahrzeit. 3 years ago, and it was, and the Intrepid, it was Clinton with the Rabin family. As a matter of fact, in this book, there's a, one of the essays is written by Noah Rothman. You will remember Noah Rothman. She's Yitzhak Rabin's granddaughter, and she gave, remember, at the Hesped, at Rabin's, you know, grandfather, you were the you know, the Amud Ha'esh, Lefnei HaMachana, and now we're left in darkness. She wrote a beautiful, we used to call these missives, filled with Chazal, really. So I'm just showing the other side. But anyway, this is what Clinton said. He said, as he was walking down the his daughter, you know, to on a wedding, he said he could hear Yitzhak, because, you know, Clinton loved Rabin. I can tell you many times, I was with them together several times. You could not mention Rabin after his assassination of Clinton without tears coming to his eye, to his eyes. Anyhow, he said, he said, as I was walking down to marry Chelsea off, I could hear Yitzhak Rabin in his deep, gravelly voice saying to him, "Bill, you finally got it right." So, you know, I didn't put that in the book. You know, I tell it in this kind of an environment because, you know, it's a matter of great concern. You know, the level of intermarriage in America is stunning. It's disastrously so.
Now that it's become fashionable, a lot of people eat fish raw. So all the stories about the tuna in the can cooking or salmon or ishun, is it nechal chai? So now it's no longer an issue?
Good question. Actually, in this tshuva that I wrote to Rabbi Shavir, one of the tzadim was, and this is a shot, is this called nowadays, is it nechal kamo shuchai? Because tuna is eaten in sushi, which became very common, is nechal kamo shuchai. So in Japan, it's certainly nechal kamo shuchai. That's the way they eat fish. So it might be considered nechal kamo shuchai. I don't think it's a winning argument, because then we'd also say, well, what about steak? Would we say steak? Because you can make tartar sauce and so on. So things can be treated different ways that can be eaten raw, but that's not the normal way to eat it. Fish is different, because sushi is the, you know. So it's a sniff, but only a sniff. No. I was saying, correct. I was saying only as relates to the issue of pasakum, but it's got to be kosher. If it has lard in it, it's not kosher. So if you know that the ingredients happens at Wonder Bread, God bless you, is coming under the OU. But you have to know that it's kosher. Wonder Bread, you know, one of the wonderful things about the concern about health, just in terms of, is, you know, there are lots of ingredients in bread that might not, for example, how is it that bread that your wife bakes, or now in the, maybe you bake, you know, we live in a different time. So how is it that home baked doesn't stay as fresh as long as things that you buy on the shelf? Well, the answer is because they put certain emulsifiers in that stop the crystallization, the oxidation. Those emulsifiers could be non-kosher. They could be animal-derived. There are lots of other ingredients. I mean, even if we eliminate lard, used to be that most breads in the United States were made, you know, with lard. That's not the case anymore. So you have to know that the ingredients are kosher, but if you know the ingredients are kosher, I was just saying, if you buy it from a commercial bakery, passepartout won't be a problem.
So
the answer is Chazal, you know, whenever there's a takon or gzeira, you know, aside from the motivation, it has its formal structure, you know, structure, how they formulated it. So, I mentioned that, you know, there may be the motivation for it, but then beyond the motivation is also the how it's formulated. So that's every legal system is based on that.
So if thank you very much, Rabbi Ganak. I'm just going to stop you short here. If anyone has any questions afterwards, please feel free.